morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever and whenever you may be, and welcome to episode 148 of the Fade to Black podcast. I'm Hannah Flint.
I'm Clarice Lockery.
And I'm Amon Woman.
This week, I speak to Tunisian director Kawfa Benhania about blending reality and fiction in Four Daughters. We also review the film, plus we set up our space worms and head out to tackle Denis Villeneuve's Dune Part 2, and the comedy horror Lisa Frankenstein from Diablo Cody and Zelda Williams. Plus, in our hot take, we complete the Missionaria Protectiva and chat Dune Part 2 spoilers. So before we get into it, how's everyone's week been? Clarice, what's cracking?
Not good. Yeah. I've just been very sick this week. So I have nothing. I'm nothing. I just was in bed for a week.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Not great.
But also, you kind of know where this thing kicked off.
Well, I don't want to say.
What happened from a dream turned into a nightmare.
This is the thing. I don't, because, you know, last week I said I had the best sushi in the world.
You did. You had a ratatouille mind-blowing experience eight times.
I say it's definitely that because I don't want to tell people not to go to that restaurant because the chef was so nice and so talented. So I don't want to say, you know, I don't want to say, but I did learn this week that like 75% of oysters have norovirus in them.
Oh boy.
And I'm pretty sure that's what I had this week. Because it was incredibly painful and unpleasant. So that's my life, though, isn't it? I have an oyster for the second time ever, and I ate the oyster being like, this one's so much better than last time. Because the first time I had an oyster, I was with a boyfriend's parents beating them for the first time, and I gagged violently in front of them, and it was incredibly embarrassing. And I was so like, oh, wow, maybe I can eat oysters now. No.
I'm so sorry you went through that.
Yeah, that's not
fun. Amon, okay. are you glad that you didn't make it?
I am.
Actually,
now.
you can't no. have fish anyway, right?
Yeah. No, I was, you know, feeling FOMO for a split second, but now I'm like, you know what? I'm good. I'm good here.
Yeah.
It's always a good week when I get to chat to Mr. Hans Zimmer, Hannah Go.
What? Zimmer, who got the keys to my dinner?
I expected that quicker. But yes, talk to Mr. Hans Zimmer about Dune Part 2, which we will, of course, be talking about in greater detail in just a few minutes. But yeah, he is amazing. It was a really fun chat. Even though it was virtual and not in person this time, we still had a really great time. So yeah, and hopefully I was talking to him about his live shows and about what he should play at his next live show. So if you hear the Prince of Egypt in the next Hans Zimmer live show, know that I sowed the seed for that. Thank you very much, and you're welcome.
There we go. Well, what have I been doing this week? Oh, I wrote a couple of pieces, saw some films. I don't know, typical life of a critic, eh? Should we just crack on and get in to it?
Let's do it.
Here's the trailer for our first film, Four Daughters.
اللي فهمته من الفيلم اللي مش تكون يكون دوري كما دور روس في فيلم تيتانيك. هي مش تحكي في حكاية فاتت فهم ممثلين أخرين اللي هم مش يمثلوا الواقع اللي متاع القصة هذيك معناتها إني روز
ألفا عندها أربع بنات جوز صغار إيه وتيسير مازالوا عايشين معاها والجوز الكبار رحمة وغفران كليهم الذيب وزادة باش تتعرفوا على الجوز ممثلات اللي باش يمثلوا أخواتكم الكبار
إما فما ممثلة باش تعوضك وقت اللي انت شي حوايج صعبة عليك ما تنجمش تعملهم.
هذا هو الجانب الخايب في الفيلم، بدا نبرشوا في الجروح نتاعنا.
أكسيون.
Never knew how much I missed ya. Now that everybody knows, I ain't ever gonna let you go. Sister. That is 90s classic. probably not the right tone for this film, but, you know, fade to black whenever we ever got the right tone. Blurring the lines between documentary and drama, Four Daughters tells us true story of Olfa Hamrouni, a Tunisian woman and mother to four daughters. Her two elder daughters, Hofrain and Rama, have fled home to Libya to join Islamic State, while her two young daughters, Ia and Taysir, remain. To fill the absence of Olfa's two missing daughters, director Kawtha Benhania sets up an extraordinary film mechanism as we see the family come together with professional actors working collectively to retell their story. Written and directed by Kawtha Benhania, it features Hen Sabri, Olfa Hamrouni, Ia Shekaui, Taysir Shekaui, Noor Karoui, Ikraq Matar, and Majd Mastura. And so this has been, for me personally, like a somewhat dream come true. I really love Kawtha Benhania, of course, more than the fact that she's a Tunisian filmmaker, but I think she's an amazing director. Beauty and the Dogs is amazing. Obviously, we spoke about The Man Who Sold His Skin a few years ago. So yeah, so it was really cool to talk to her about this film in the context of like the political climate in Tunisia, change that was going on in the background. And, you know, I think that's a really important part of this film to understand like the wider context, to look at the personal and how, you know, this kind of sort of radicalization would happen. But also it was really interesting to look at like the kind of actor versus real people dynamic, and kind of getting the performance out there, but also, yeah, that sort of the way it shot. Also, we kind of talked about the place that they shot in, which is really interesting. So anyway, let's have the interview. So please enjoy. Kawtha, thank you so much for speaking today, and congratulations on Four Daughters. It's such a remarkable feature of like, narrative documentary making, the blending of fact and the fiction and the actors. And I guess, how did you come across, like, what point were you kind of realizing that this is something that you want to kind of blend, kind of set up scenes with actors, but also, of course, Olfa and her daughters?
It took me a long time to find out how I want to tell this story, in which form at least, because I started this project in 2016, and in the beginning I was thinking about doing a more conventional documentary, but quickly I understood that this story is so complex and so multi-layered that I need something else. So little by little, I mean, during all those years, doubting, thinking, and at some point maybe thinking about abandoning the project, because the project wasn't easy at all. This story is a kind of minefield. You can get lost easily in it. So I put it aside. Then I did The Man Who Sold His Skin, my previous movie, which is a feature film. And then I came back and I was thinking, but why I want to tell this story? I mean, the main answer is to understand. And if I want to understand, because there is the headline, and then why this tragedy happened. So if I want to understand, I have to go dig in the past of this family. And how you film past when you want to do a documentary, since the past is not available anymore to be filmed. So you use actors to bring this past to the present, to summon it, and then to understand it also. So this was mainly the journey of figuring out how to tell this story.
Yeah, what you said about the headlines, and I think in the last couple of years, there's been, you know, we had You Resemble Me, which kind of looked at a real life story. We had Co-Pilot as well, which is like the female perspective. Her husband becomes like radicalized. And I guess there is such a, I guess outwardly, the Arab world or Arab people of Arab heritage, certainly when it comes to fundamentalist religion, is often kind of given a very like stereotypical example. So I suppose with you, were those kind of things you were thinking about, especially showing like how, because it's like no one just suddenly decides they're going to be a terrorist overnight. There are these stepping stones. So were you kind of aware of like the, I guess, the orientalist outward projections of people from North Africa and Middle Eastern world and the diaspora when you were kind of making it?
Sure. I mean, I'm not naive. I can see how how Arab and Muslim can be represented. But at the same time, I think that, as you said, it's very important, at least for me, to take a common idea, common cliche, maybe, like radicalization, and try me as a person from this region, but also me as a filmmaker, a writer, to understand the deepest mechanism of it, and to make it, how to say, accessible to the audience all over the world, so they can see. I mean, when you watch this movie, and I've been showing it since Cannes till today, all over the world, you relate a lot to those women. There is a shared humanity about being daughters, about being a mother, about inheritance of generation. Trauma. So behind the label, behind the cliche, there is always a complex story full of life where you can find the shared humanity. And I think this is very important to show and to tell stories, and not to be afraid of the labels and cliche, because when you film the reality, you can easily go beyond them and eradicate those cliché and labels.
Yeah, and you know what you're saying about it's a, such a complex story, but also I find Tunisia is it's such a complex country, especially after like different kind of people coming in, the Arab Spring. And I guess, I think I read in an interview that you're really interested in institutions. So of course we've got this kind of zooming in on this Ulfa and her daughter's narrative thing, but the backdrop, there's a lot of comments about, I guess, you know, hijabs not being, you know, because it's very secular, especially very secular society and Ben Ali, but like, I guess for you, how are you like balancing that, I suppose, showing this very close up story, but also kind of grappling with the wider, I guess, the institutions that allowed this sort of thing to kind of happen?
Yeah, this is one of the things that I found I'm passionate about it in this story, how the politics, or how the decision of politician can change people's life directly. This is so important to know, like politician, when we vote for them, they can change our life. And yeah, in this particular story, we can see how things, I mean, we have this important moment in Tunisia, which is the revolution, and we can see how this affected the family, because everybody in this family did his own revolution. The mother divorced and took a lover, the girls become goth. So it's like a revolutionary moment, incredible. And then you have when we voted for the far right Islamist party in Tunisia, what happened to this family? So I think that the political atmosphere is always linked to our intimate life, whether we know it or no. And this was very important, especially in this story.
Yeah. I love that you got Hend Sabri to play like Ulfa scenes, but I just love those moments where they're together. I'm sure, because you're on the Oscar run, have you seen May December at the moment?
Yeah,
that tough. And I watched your four daughters afterwards. So I was like, the way they were looking in the mirrors, and I was like, oh my god, this is like the perfect double bill of features that people should watch together. But can you just, I guess I'd love to know a little bit about you know, getting Hind involved, and I guess like, you know, the direction in those moments and kind of like mapping it out, because I guess you don't have a script, but you've got a kind of map of what you want to show and beats you want to hit. So how are you working? Like, god, that's a massive question now, I'm so sorry, but like yeah, talk a bit about getting Hind in and kind of mapping out that kind of journey.
I mean, Hind, she's a star in the region, and this part was very risky for her because she's acting as Hind, as a person. She's making visible her process of work as an actress. And she, most the most risky thing, she She don't have a character written on paper. She have the real person in front of her telling her what to do and how to do it. This was really, great, because Hind is this kind of very smart actress, willing to take risks and to learn all the time, going out of her comfort zone. And it was very fascinating to see the dialogue between her and Ulfa. They are very different women, but they like they are talking to each other in the same level of equality, because Ulfa is a fan of Hind Sabri, but she's not impressed by Hind Sabri.
Yes.
So it was just fascinating to see these two women from very different two backgrounds portraying the same women and having discussion about Ulfa's flaws and contradictions.
Although I did love the bit, the real meta, like watching Hind on screen and then playing Ulfa. It was like, this is so many layers. This is Inception. Of course, you have Noor and Ikra, who are also playing, obviously, Rama and Khalfein, who aren't there. But and then you have, is it Maj, who is plays several roles? I mean, it's so interesting. It must have been really a tough shoot, just psychologically, to get into this thing and the levels that you have to go to. And then also, I guess, certain scenes where obviously like Ian and Taysa are like talking about a lot of stuff that could be quite heavy. What was it like shooting those moments, those working with like those actors? Because I guess some with like Noor and Ikrak, they're maybe not too experienced. This might have been a real like challenge for them to kind of like embrace the improvisational nature of it as well.
Yeah, I mean, I told them from the beginning, yeah, it's not scripted. Nothing is scripted. You react as person, not you. I'll not give you dialogue to react. You react as you real life. That, because we are in a documentary movie, we are not in a fictional, it's a kind of meta, as you said, documentary. And what I love in doing documentaries, and that's why after doing fiction, I always do another documentary, is the fact that I'm the first audience of my own movie. I'm surprised. It's not scripted, so I don't know. I lose control. I mean, as a filmmaker, like all the filmmakers, we are control freak, but sometimes it's good to lose control and to be surprised by your own material, by your own characters and your own actors. And this was the case all the time in this shooting.
I love the place that you shot in. Can you tell me a little bit about that, like a house? Because did you shoot in the same place for everything? Would you just get a building, or it was I don't know. There's so much about it that it felt like it was such steeped in history, and the kind of cinematography and the lighting. I was like, this feels like somewhat gothic in a way as well. Certain shots.
I wanted to have one place for everything, to reduce the crew and to create an intimacy and a space for everybody. So the authenticity of the set wasn't very important for me, because it's a more introspective movie. It's not very realistic. So we found this, it's an hotel, actually, a very poor hotel. Cheap.
Hey,
hotel.
Look, now that this film's out, everyone's gonna go to this hotel. It's like, I want to go to the trauma bonding hotel of Four Daughters.
It's an old place, as you said, because it's called the Eiffel Tower Hotel. It was constructed at the same time when they were doing the Eiffel Tower in Paris.
Oh, wow.
So very old place. And it was in the previous century, like a fancy place for European in Medina of Tunis. And then it became a brothel. A place
sex workers, work.
And then it became an hotel, and then it started, it became a very, very cheap hotel for driver coming from Algeria, because there is a station just next to it. And then the place was closed during COVID, so we we took all over the place. We used different room. And what I loved about this place is this blue. I love the blue color.
Yeah.
And also the cachet of, you can find this in very modest home in Tunisia, like the houses where Olfa lived. So it was a place with a lot of possibilities.
I'm going to Tunisia again this year and I'm going to find it. I don't want to stay there. I guess, you know, Olfa already shared much of her story, the story of what happened already. But there's this kind of second wind of really going, excavating her past and seeing it's such a wide world. I guess, like, how has it been since you kind of made the film? Obviously, they've seen it as well. What's it been like for her to see, I guess, also see herself in that way? Because I guess people we all have different memories and we all have different perspectives and we all have our own, it's like Rashomon, right? We're all like, look at this, the truth's there, but we're all on the different sides of it. Was it interesting for her to see the film and see kind of like maybe things that she might not have seen or recalled herself?
Yeah, I mean, her first reaction when I told her, now you have to watch the movie, she told me, I know I'm horrible in the movie, you know. I told her, yes, Olfa, you are horrible, but not only. So when she saw it, she had the same reaction. It's okay, like I'm a more nuanced character here. And the daughters loved the movie. They were really happy about the way they are filmed, about hearing their voice, having a voice and talking. And since we premiered the movie at Cannes, so we did the red carpet together, it was very intense moment. And since then, they were traveling a lot with the movie. Like the previous month, they were in Germany for the German release. And yeah, they are proud of the movie and they are traveling with it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I feel like they could become actors themselves. I wonder if that's something they thought about. Are they going to pursue maybe some working in film?
Yeah, I mean, I loved filming them. I find them very photogenic and they are very very talented. But you know, in Tunisia we don't have an industry. All no. Tunisians want to be actors, and we do
yeah. I know, it's getting better though, because I feel like there are I don't know, for me, like, it's really helped me connect with my Tunisian heritage through cinema, you know, and obviously like him being in like The Silence of the Palaces is like one of the best. So I guess like hopefully we'll kind of see more. And we've got like Under the Fig Trees and obviously You. Oh my God. Yeah. So I hope there'll be more coming out to Tunisia, and I can't wait to see what you need to do next. And obviously I'm rooting for you for the Oscars. I hope you win. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Anna. Thank you very much.
So I guess I one thing I felt watching this was like this would be a really good double feature with May December.
Yes, I thought the same thing.
Okay, well, Imam, please like expand on that for me.
Yeah, so they have. I'm gonna get the name right. Hold on. They have not only an actress, Hen Sabri, to come and play scenes of Olfa Hamrouni's character when it gets too overwhelming for her, but they also have other actors to come and play the two missing daughters. And so, especially when it comes to Hen Sabri and Olfa, there are scenes where we see her trying to get the cadence right. There are scenes where we see her trying to sort of mirror and sort of, you know, get all the body language right of Olfa so that she can portray her well when they reenact certain scenes. So anytime those scenes came up, it was like, oh, this is very, very May December like. And yeah, this blend of fact and fiction was very, very interesting to me. It made for a very unique experience almost, because you're both in the scene with the actors and also the people they are portraying in a way, because there are times when Olfa is just in the background while Hen Sabri is playing her in the scene. So we're both in the scene and outside the scene at the same time. And I found that to be a very interesting and at times very heartbreaking experience, because the other thing about this movie that really struck me is how close or how much it would oscillate between the joy and also the pain. Because on the one hand, you have something where it's wonderful because it is what was lost is now gained back, because there are times when you can fool yourself into thinking this is a happy reunited family because they got these roles down so well and everyone is interacting so naturally. But then almost, you know, in the same scene, sometimes the pain of their absence will come to the fore for the mother and the two remaining sisters. And the fact that you got all of that sometimes in 2-3 minutes of packages, it was really powerful to me.
Clarice, did you similarly have felt quite affected about the kind of, I guess, the reality versus fiction style, the blend and the recreation of scenes, but also like having like Ulfa in it, watching and kind of also in a way a director?
Yeah, I think what really hit me was I think it's the idea of being forced to step outside of yourself. And some of my favorite scenes were actually when Hend Sabri would confront Ulfa. Which usually, you know, we hear actors talk about like, oh, to get into this role, you know, you just really have to like kind of believe the character's motivations and like, you know, just accept that they, you know what they're doing and they think what they're doing is right. So it was kind of, I liked seeing an actor go, hold up, like, what the fuck were you thinking treating your daughters like this? Because, you know, it's a very complicated portrait of motherhood, because the way that sequentially kind of the story is set out is that we learn about Ulfa's trauma and then we see then that how that's passed on to the daughters. And it's really like, I mean, that's all quite hard to watch, because you see it becomes so plain to you. And I think I think it's kind of in these situations, and we were talking about the radicalism here, people don't want to talk about the process behind it and like the human psychological process that leads someone to get there, and it is shit like this. And I, for me on a personal level, I'm very like pro exploring that, and I'm pro talking about these things, about how do people get to these places, what makes people do the shit that they do. And I think literally having like the woman either have to act out her own actions and also the daughters, or to see them played out in front of them, I mean, that's basically therapy. Like this movie is like a strange but really effective for, and I guess it reminded me, like, obviously very different shit, but the logic of it reminded me of The Act of Killing, this idea of like what happens when you're kind of confronted with your own actions in a different kind of through the artistic process, which I guess also then May December, that links, it's all kind of linked. But I find, yeah, I just found this like amazing and incredible to think about what's going on with all the people in these scenes.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting if you look at, you know, especially when it comes to this sort of terrorism related to like Islamic State, and, you know, historically when it comes to this sort of representational screen or how it's explored, it's a very like, you know, it's always like from the terrorist attack to that. It's never really understanding, as you said, getting into understand why someone would be converted. But I feel like this is like a part of a recent conversation about that from like, you remember, did we do You Resemble Me on the show, on the French film by Dina Amer? And it's, I can't remember if we covered it on the show, but that similarly got into like the true story, kind of getting behind the headlines, because this story was big in Tunisia during the time and did interviews. So it's kind of like, you know, getting behind the headlines and having a better understanding of what can cause it, which I thought was great. I also thought it was just, I felt like the daughters who were, I think it's Ia and Taysa, who who were the real daughters in it, how they, you know, there's a scene where they're talking about her mother's boyfriend and they have an actor in the scene who plays like quite a few roles in it. Mm-hmm. But he's talking about like how when like talking about the sexual abuse that they experienced. And it, I think like one thing that really made it potent was just like, you know, how the discomfort of the actors in this scene, because they're having to like improvise on the spot, because it is basically all improvisation, which is what's quite amazing with it. Mm. But like just how I suppose the kind of like the bluntness and the ability for these girls to kind of just go through it, and even through tears go through it. And it's kind of like, you're just acting. This is what happened to them. I wonder how you felt. Was there any particular scene that kind of stood out for you as like really, I don't know, really great getting into that? Because that for me was a really perfect scene to get into like the meta narrative going on, but also like the sort of different layers of fact and fiction, and then using then the real people playing it out, but then going through that re-experiencing that trauma, and then the actors kind of dealing with it. And then obviously the people around them, you're on a set as well. So it really gets into this kind of real blurred vision of what's going on in order to get this, like, as you mentioned, like this cathartic release.
Well, it's sort of like art. I think the way that they're able to be so blunt about their trauma is, I think, almost because art can create a safe space, because they're not, they're in the film, right? They're not just having to talk about what happened to them. They're kind of play acting as the character of themselves. And I think there's something that's almost sort of sometimes why people make art, because it's so hard to just talk about the experience. But if you remove it one step, suddenly it's freeing, and you can be free to actually say the things that are really difficult to say otherwise. And I think, yeah, that scene you mentioned, there's that scene you mentioned with the the boyfriend, where the actor gets so uncomfortable that he's like, I need to go. Which is fair enough. And then I think there was a scene later on where they're talking about the mother and how she treated them to her face. And I was thinking, God, I bet this is the shit that they have never been able to vocalize their entire lives, because they couldn't just go up to her and be like, hey, have you ever thought about the way that you treated us? It was like, not great. But because they've been given the license of this space that they are making this documentary, this film, and that it's art, and also to have the actresses there, the director, for them, that they suddenly have this art. And there's a great scene where the daughters are talking about, oh, it's something to do with periods. And so they're talking about body or body hair or something.
Oh, yeah.
And the mom's like,
there's a man here.
There's a man here. But I love the daughter going, yeah, but he's like directing, we're doing, you know, this is filming, this is art. I'm like, yes. Like, I love that. It is a really difficult film, and obviously maybe ethically there's a question of like, you know, should you make people relive their trauma for art? But to put that aside for a second, I actually think there's something there's something really liberating about it, because it's like, oh, they've been given this opportunity to say all the shit that they have not been able to say their entire lives, because they have this like little buffer zone of a director and a cameraman.
The one you talked about all the stuff, all the name calling, you know, they're there, like hen Sabres to the side. What I find so interesting about that scene is that they're all laughing. And I think that's so interesting to me, because it's like, they're just laughing at the things they say. And it's only like Hen who says, you said that to your daughters? Like, that's really bad. It's like, that's what I think often I think what he really captures is how often when we look back at really traumatic things, we laugh about it because it's at distance. But it's also like, you kind of need this like objective outsider to be like, hold on, that is not great.
Yeah, no, 100% agree with that. I think another scene that speaks to that is when Olfa is recounting what happened on her wedding night. Which is, you know, you tell that story a different way and it could easily come across as the trauma that it perhaps was on the night. But the way that she tells it is so much wit and humor in it. And she's laughing about it and we're laughing about it, and it ends up being one of the funniest scenes in the movie. And just Ulfa as a general sort of screen presence in this was so fun to watch for good chunks of this movie. I really enjoyed learning more about her and her story.
I think it's a really good film about contradictions. And I guess that sort of, not just contradictions in like the real people and stuff, but also how we kind of make assumptions, the contradictions of what we see as, like, in this case, what is expected of a Tunisian woman. I think the whole thing as well with the kind of the hijabs and how that plays into it a lot of time. Although I have to say my favorite, I think one of my favorite moments is when, because Hen Sabri is like a famous kind of Tunisian actress, and she was in this film, Le Silence of the Palaces, which is like a famous like Tunisian film back in the day. I think it's one of her first roles. But there's a bit where they're watching her on TV in a show, and they're having to like, it's like, oh, she's a slut. It's like that Hen Sabri. I quite like that bit. So this is out in cinemas. It's a screen, stream, or skip verdict. Clarice?
Screen.
Aman?
Screen.
Oh, screens all round. So from four daughters to two stepsisters, this is Lisa Frankenstein.
There's a young man. I talked to him.
I wish I was with you.
That's really weird, Lisa.
I'm the greatest God created. Power tripping on the mission.
Taffy says it's a waste of time to try and fix a boy. It's better just accept a guy's flaws.
Oh, that's so cute.
I can't do that. Not until we bury the body.
There is no turning back now. I can't be saved. And in the next life they'll remember me. Remember me.
Really hope this goth phase ends soon.
Wake me up inside.
Can't wake up.
Wake me up inside.
Save me.
Come and save me from the dark. This is Lisa Frankenstein, a misunderstood teenager and a reanimated Victorian corpse. Oh, that's why he looks like, what's his face from Corpse Bride? I was wondering that. I did see the poster for this. And a reanimated Victorian corpse embark on a murderous journey together to find love, happiness, and a few missing body parts. Directed by Zelda Williams and written by Diablo Cody, it stars Catherine Newton, Cole Sprouse, Liza Soberano, Henry Eikenberry, Joe Crest, and Carla Gugino. Oh, cool. Oh, yeah. So I didn't see Lisa Frankenstein. I tried on Monday morning. I got ready. I put all my makeup on, all my clothes. And then I was like, now it's time to leave and get out the door. And I took two steps and just went boom. So I'm quite sad to have missed this because it seems really fun. I mean, Hannah, are you a Diablo Cody fan in general? I feel like.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, Jennifer's Body.
I mean, Juno, Ovs. I loved I think Young Adult was great.
So how does this compare in the Diablo
Tully,
Cody?
Was that the other one as well? Tully was her other one as well.
Yeah. Is this up there with those, would you say?
I think, no. to put it bluntly.
Thank you.
No, you know what? It's actually a really sad thing to say about this, but I do actually think that the script is the weakest part of it. I've always loved, but it's funny, Denis Villeneuve would disagree, but I love good dialogue. But I always felt like Diablo's writing, her, the way she could kind of turn a phrase and characters and when he speak. And yeah, it was a bit kind of somewhat heightened, but I just love the way that her characters converse and the way they deliver a line. And I guess the sharpness of it as well. And I felt like this one, it had a few moments of, oh, that's quite funny. But I think the biggest gags were really towards the kind of visual humor that was going on. And also performances of Catherine Newton and secondary to hers, like Cole Sprouse. I think for me, they're the really shining kind of standouts. I mean, a script that, yeah, hasn't got as much bark or bite as something like a Jennifer's Body or Juno. And yeah, it seems to be more kind of, I guess maybe that's because it's maybe a younger rating. This is a kind of 12A or PG-13 rating compared to what would have been like 15 certificates. I don't know if that's got anything to do with it. And it's a bit more kind of, certainly in the way it looks and delivered, it's a bit more Tim Burton-esque. There's lots of references. It feels like Edward Scissorhands and Beetlejuice are pretty big references, as well as like Heathers. But Heathers, of course, is one of those biting satires out there. So I guess in being so much of a homage to some of these things, it kind of just reminds you, those ones are classics. I'm not sure if this will be like as much of a classic, but I do think it's quite as... I think it's quite fun for now.
Because we are not short of Frankenstein narrative. So I think when it was first announced, it was a bit like, oh, okay, here we go. This is like, I feel like there's five of these. Yeah, was it Warm Bodies? Like, there's so many. The zombie or Rihanna, whatever, Frankenstein rom-com thing has been done. In terms of that, in terms of it being a Frankenstein thing, was there anything interesting or different or notable about this?
Little things here and there. I like the fact that in order to, piece him back together, he has to go to a malfunctioning tanning station periodically to get new pieces. I thought that was a nice touch. And there's things here and there that I was like, okay, yeah, that's quite clever. But as Hannah alluded to, it's only in flashes. It's never super consistent all the way through. And for me, I needed a lot more interiority for Lisa, especially, than what we got. And also just a little bit more world building as well, because there are things that happen fairly soon into the film, which has a lot of sort of tonal shifts and all the rest of it, that I didn't quite know how to react to some of what I was watching, in part because the work hadn't been done to really get you into Lisa's headspace. Because at the start of this film, she's sort of reeling from a tragedy. Like, she witnessed her mum being killed, essentially. There was a home invasion, and we sort of start her off there. And then she's moved in with her stepsister and her dad's sort of new partner. But when things start going supernatural, as the film sort of quickly moves into, it's so erratic. I couldn't quite figure out how she felt about some of the murders, for instance, that are going on. And therefore, I was like kind of half chuckling, half laughing, half, okay, is this really mattering? Does she believe it matters? Does she even care that she's killing all these people? There wasn't enough work done on that for me to have that emotional anchor for the film as I was watching. Does that make any sort of sense?
Yeah. I guess my thing is, I kind of like the fact that she's, I think it's, the whole thing from the beginning, she kind of prefers the company of like dead people than real people. I think it's like this thing where she's kind of, you know, she is an outsider. I kind of like the fact that she embraces like murdering and she's like, oh, this is fun. You know, I do think you're right. It doesn't, it's under, like, and I guess it's that thing where it's again clinging on to the tropes of like a high school movie of she fancies this guy. And there's a big, like, there's a, not a big one, but I think there's, it's interesting. There's a speech at the end where she finds out, like, you know, she gets the brutal truth of the guy that she's so-called guy that she fancies while she's also trying to help this Cole Sprouse's Frankenstein old pianist get his body back together. So it's like, okay, so you still want that guy, but this guy, so do you, are you in love with this? You know what I mean? Again, it's kind of not very clear about the kind of, I guess, the triangle quadruple thing that's going on. And she kind of does this like, oh, guys say they want smart girls, but actually they don't want them to be smarter than them. You know, one of those sort of kind of feminist speech, but it's a kind of sort of weightless a bit. And I think that's the problem. Again, it's like, I think it's a little bit superficial in that kind of retelling, but I do quite like the fact that, you know, it's a film where it's like, oh, we don't give a shit if we're killing people. And actually, they're quite funny in the way that they get killed or like get murdered.
That's true.
It seems to be also a film that's really getting at, you know, there's a, I think there's a line early on about like, it's kind of getting taken a not like a knockout or like that making a dig at film bro culture. The kind of like the way that, well, because like, it's interesting because she's obviously a film girl. Like, if she was around now, she'd definitely have a Letterboxd account. You know, she, and there's some interesting sequences where it's like, it seems to be inspired by like, you know, Bride of Frankenstein, black and white animation, like silhouette animation sequence to start it off with. It's like Georges Méliès, you know, Trip to the Moon referenced a lot. And so, and you know, there's a bit where she says something like when she gets her drink spike and this guy's like, who's your favorite director? And I think she says, what's this, what's she say? She says, she's like, she goes, Pabst. And he thinks she's talking about the beer in his hand.
Oh, Pabst Blue Ribbon.
Yeah. So that sort of thing. So there's kind of funny moments. There's also a really fun, funny delivered line where she goes, where she comes in and she's drinking sherry or something. And her dad goes, her dad, who very much reminds me of the dad in Heathers. And I think purposefully so, you know, the kind of newspaper. She's like, God, why do I smoke these? Because you're an idiot. Know. You know, that's
patronized bunny rabbits.
Yeah. but there's a bit where he goes, is that sherry? And she looks at him deadpan and goes, no, it's Lisa. And that's what I mean. It's good delivery and stuff. So I think it's not, see what I mean? It's a bit frothy. It doesn't really, it's not, I don't think if it's trying to say much. I think it's just like trying to have a bit of fun. And then, you know, having a weirdo character as the lead who's, you know, by the end of it, you're like, oh, good for her.
Yeah. I mean, I will say, I think Catherine Newton is fantastic. The first time I saw her on screen was in an episode of Supernatural, way back when. I used to watch that show, ended a couple of years ago. Good stuff. But yeah, even then, she was like a guest star. I was like, okay, there's something different about her that, and I think that's why she was brought back in several episodes. And yeah, she really leans into the manic swings and the weird energy of her character in a really cool way. And you mentioned Cole Sprouse. He is wordless for pretty much the entire movie. And he's really great at the body language, the mannerisms, and sort of bringing out the humor from that. There's a number of scenes where it's just the two of them. And she's almost trying to figure out like what he's trying to say. And that stuff is really like really funny. I also want to shout out Liza Soberano as Taffy, the stepsister. She is a star. I'm really excited to see what this movie is going to do for her career because she gets a lot, she makes a lot of her small moments. There's one line, which is one of my favorite lines in the movie. I think, Lisa says of her crush, he's cerebral. And then Taffy replies, he's in a wheelchair. which is funny. So Cleese doesn't get the joke. I promise you, when you watch the film,
it just seems kind of offensive. I don't know.
In the context of the film, it was funny. So yeah, there's some good performances here.
I kind of liked with that character, with the Taffy character, is that, again, it could have been, you know, some of the high school tropes are still in there, but they really subverted that of, like, oh, the mean stepsister thing, right? I think that was quite nice. That was like, oh, they're kind of, what was supposed to be funny is that they're kind of like that meme that's like the black golf house next to the pink house. That's kind of what they are, which I quite enjoyed.
Yeah. Good costumes in this. At least you're going to enjoy that.
Victorian corpse sounds like a fart. Is it Jughead levels of, what's that line stated? Because you hadn't noticed. I'm weird. I'm a weirdo.
That's so funny.
Carlo Gugino, I don't think I've ever, have I seen her do a funny thing before? Is she funny in this?
She's
very camp. Yeah,
she's playing like the mean stepmom, who's kind of a type A narcissist.
Yeah.
Okay, I see the vision. So let's go to screen stream or skip on Lisa Frankenstein Hannah.
I'll say screen.
I'm on.
Stream.
And I say nothing.
Okay, Jack Reacher.
from a beating heart with no rhythm to walking with no rhythm, it's Dune Part 2.
It's okay. I'm here. It's been a while since you've had one of those nightmares. Tell me, what was it about?
Only fragments. Nothing's clear. You've been fighting the Harkonnens for decades.
Look!
My family's been fighting them for centuries.
Your blood comes from dukes, them great houses. Here, we're equal. What we do for the benefit of all.
Well, I'd very much like to be equal to you.
Maybe I'll show you the way.
Deal with this prophet.
Send assassins.
Faderatha, he's psychotic.
See possible futures all at once, and in so many futures our enemies prevail. But I do see a way. There is a narrow way through.
That's me in the sandworm. That's me in the sand light.
Oh boy.
Spreading my
religion.
Okay, Paul Atreides unites with Chani and the Fremen while seeking revenge against the conspirators who destroyed his family. Facing a choice between the love of his life and the fate of the universe, he must prevent a terrible future that only he can foresee. It's directed by Denis Villeneuve from a screenplay by Villeneuve and John Spates. It stars Timothée Chalamet, Zendaya, Rebecca Ferguson, Josh Brolin, Austin Butler, Florence Pugh, Dave Bautista, Christopher Walken, Lea Seydoux, Sihelia Yacoub, Stellan Skarsgård, Charlotte Rampling, and Javier Bardem. So there's not many people in this cast, is what we're saying. No. Stacked. So Dune Part 1, what I've been sort of reading a lot of online is that Dune Part 1 was the setup. Dune Part 2 is at least part of the payoff. Does that ring true for you, Clarice?
I saw a tweet that said, no one will get this reference except me. Dune Part 1 is the loading screen of Fortnite. And Dune Part 2 is you after you get your first kill.
I like that.
And I can't describe how correct that is. I would say what was interesting about Dune Part 1 is that it had so much of an easier job because it was all atmosphere is kind of, it's such a, I love that movie. And it, when I think about it, it's very weird because it's 100% set up and vibes and just establishing the mood and saying, okay, there's this guy and he's been established with this destiny that if he follows is going to lead to really bad shit. And then the movie ends. So I think that left Dune Part 2 with a lot of, I was kind of quite worried about it because I've read the books and that second half of the book, it's, I think people are right when to have called it unadaptable for decades, because like, what the fuck do you do with any of that? It's a lot. It's very complicated and extremely weird. And you know, if David Lynch can't do it, then, but you know, he did it. I don't know how, but he did it. And it's confusing and impressive to me.
Yeah. Yeah. I watched this film in IMAX. The spectacle was just so staggering to me, and it just felt very rare. Like, we watch a lot of action films doing what we do, but the spectacle on the level that Denis is working on here felt special. And as I said, you know, rare. There's a number of scenes that stand out to me in that regard. You know, sandworms are ridden into battle. That's incredible. There's a scene where the Fremen take out Harkonnen ships, which is so well designed and really brilliantly paced. And then the hand-to-hand combat, when it comes, especially in the final act, which we'll talk about more in spoilers, is really, really impressive. On an action level, Hannah, your face is telling me what your answer is going to be, but what did you think of the spectacle of Dune Part 2?
Well, you know, you said this thing that Denis interviewed recently, and he says, like, he's just all about, he really cares about visuals more than, he would love to do a film where he didn't have to do any dialogue. And with that in, like, quote in mind, it explains a lot about this franchise, because it is so much more focused on, like, the grandiose, like, giving this kind of, I guess, the world building, I guess at the expense of, like, for me, certainly in Part 2, any sort of granular character development, of the kind of influx of characters, because there's so many characters in this one. And I guess I would say for Paul and Jessica, I think that was the best bit of character development and getting the real interiority of what they're going through. But on a scale of like the kind of action, yeah, some of the early action sequences were great. I found that the final act was anticlimactic, rushed. I didn't care for the fight. I thought that there was a hand-to-hand combat scene that was fine. But, you know, we see them riding into battles, sandworms, and that lasts about 2 minutes. It's like, there's so much build-up to get to this point. And I just, yeah, I felt. And then also because they've changed a lot of from the book, that they've kind of ended on another cliffhanger, which doesn't happen in the book. And I feel like, oh, it felt like for me, I was like, oh, great. So unresolved again.
The book is so rushed. The ending of the book is insane. Like, it's just like, blah, blah, blah. So I feel like I think maybe that struck me. I was like, oh, it doesn't feel, and especially if you watch the Lynch version, which I think kind of sticks to the ending of the book more coherently, that movie as well, just like, it just ends and you're like, okay, bye, I guess. So I think maybe that's one of the complicated parts of adapting Dune, is that what Frank Herbert thought was an ending for him, he then had to write Dune Messiah because people kept misunderstanding his ending. And he was like, everybody shut up, stop getting Dune wrong. I'm going to write another book to explain it to you. So I guess that's the, like, what you're talking about is like, how do you even tackle that ending? Because
no, I disagree. I don't find it as abrupt as the film, because they've changed a character. They've changed the scene. I mean, they've changed a lot about the ending of that book, about certain, I mean, again, we'll get to spoilers, but I think for me, I guess it's with the character of Chani, which they've changed a lot. And they've also kind of,
Yeah, they stripped out a lot because there's a lot. There's a thing about in the book where there's an exchanging of knowledge between Jessica and Paul and the Fremen. So like they've got their own fight. Jessica teaches like the Ben Gesserit way of fighting and all this type of stuff. So there's this whole kind of bonding thing that goes that kind of goes on between them where they become more linked together, which is stripped out of it. Plus there's a whole thing with the baby that's taken out of it. And I kind of understand why, because that's like fucking weird and complicated. But I felt like, and I guess it goes to the kind of, I feel like the way that this romance presented with Timothy and Paul Chani, and then of course we got Arulian involved as well. It felt like really young adult romance, very basic. And again, it's this sort of, I felt, you know, well, not just Chani, but most of the Fremen, it was like all that they really were like either, or, you know, all we knew about them is that they care about like fighting, survival, and like religious fanaticism. There's really nothing else to them or any kind of character development that presented them more than this. And, you know, even like Chani, it's like, so she's this Federican like warrior and devout to a nation, but not to the faith. And so again, you know, there's this, who she is beyond that, don't really know. This Sharon Duncan Brewster being her Liet Kynes in the first film, I, you know, from the books, that's her mother, father, whatever you want to do it. There's no reference to that. They have this blue scarf that she wears. And I don't know if that's trying to be a nod to like a plot point in the film or if not. So again, it's like this for me, what frustrates me, this is 2 hours, 48 minutes. And I feel like, again, like a lot of the substantial things like depth is not really there for me. And therefore, when it came to the ending where we spent all this time not exploring the Fremen beyond, you know, being obsessed with the Mahdi or whatever, then we just get to an end bit that's like, oh, okay, that's it. And then something about Chani, which is like, okay, they're just setting up for a third film. So for me, I just felt like this, you know, as it came of two half, like I know you said about vibes and stuff in the first film, but that was like starting a narrative arc and not finishing it. And for me, that didn't satisfy at all. And then this one, it's like, well, this is the complete picture, but it's not the complete picture. But yeah.
I will agree with you in that with Christopher Nolan and the Dark Knight trilogy, one of the reasons I love those films so much is even though, yes, they're all interconnected, after Batman Begins, Nolan could have easily left it there. There was resolution.
They're discrete projects.
Yeah. After The Dark Knight, there was resolution. He could have left it there. I don't think you can say the same for this Dune series. So on that, I agree. But in terms of Paul's journey specifically and what he is dealing with here and sort of the do or don't of destiny and love, I was very compelled by that. And I feel like, you know, I felt that way because the relationship with Chani was so rich. And I think Timothée and Zendaya are fantastic together. There's one scene in particular that stands out to me where Paul is like, you know, I am a Fremen. I'm trying to help the people, something to that nature. And it's like, do you believe me? And Zendaya as Chani takes a good like 5 seconds to verbally respond because she's studying. It's almost like he's studying his base to really sort of try and see. There's so much going on there with Zendaya. I think she's fantastic in this film. So I was really pulled in by that. And then the other side of that is the relationship between Paul and Jessica, which has its own complications and really fascinating scenes. And there's scenes where Rebecca Ferguson is just in all her weird manic energy is just like staring daggers at Paul. Again, I was really, really taken by it. So because of those two things, I thought it was a very complex narrative. And even though there's a sense of inevitability to it, there are scenes where I was like, oh, it's a really tricky situation this guy is in. And I was really pulled in by his story. Clarice, did you feel the same?
Yeah, I think I think what was cut from the book and what was changed like makes like a lot of sense to me.
I haven't read the book, I should say.
So Chani, it's cold. So like Chani here in the movie is sort of the audience, because she's the skeptical voice,
mm-hmm.
which I think for, you know, a 2.5 hour movie, you kind of do need some of those narrative changes. And I think that really worked for me because it gave a lot of clarity to kind of the forked path that Paul is pushed along. And I think talking about this thing about Denis Villeneuve, I didn't super read the full quote, but there's the thing about him preferring visual language over dialogue. One of my favorite bits is just the fact that there is, in a really key scene, he cuts to a close-up of Paul's hands, and he does this like hand movement that basically tells you everything you need to know about where the story's going next. And I was like, that's incredible to me, that kind of shorthand of going what was pages and pages and pages in Frank Herbert's book to explain why Paul gets the place that he is by the end of the movie. By the end of the book, in the movie, it's done with a hand gesture. So I think for me, what really stuck out to me about the film is that it is both grandeur and intimacy. And I've really felt like I got the balance of both, because there is spectacle, but there are these just really small choices about where the camera goes in certain moments, and also silence. Like, cause you have this Hans Zimmer score that's I had a full ass massage by the end of this movie because my chair was shaking so much. Like the absolute intensity of that fucking score. Yeah. But then there's these moments where there's nothing. There's in the sandworm scene, there's a good example of that. And the choices are so thoughtfully made that it just has such an impact. So I kind of get what he means about the dialogue thing. Because yeah. Sometimes you don't need words. You can say it through something as simple as what you decide the camera should cut to in that moment.
Elise, thank you for teeing me up, because there's a time for me to talk about Hans Zimmer's score, which is so freaking good in this film. My goodness. This is one of the best spotted movies that I've seen in recent memory. And what I mean by spotting is the process by which a composer sort of looks at the film and sort of decides where and when the score should go and how it evolves. And there are so many moments in here that are so keenly observed, especially when it comes to how they use music with Paul's character, given the certain sort of really big changes and shifts that happen with him. There's a couple of tracks that really signify that in a really cool way. So Travel South, there are hints, that's the name of the track, which I've been listening to the score ad nauseum. There's a track called Travel South where the score first starts to hint that things are going down a dark path. And then there's a track called Arrival, which the film gives absolute prime placement to. It is very loud and booming, and that is when Paul has fully made a shift, and the score is just fantastic there. But even in little moments, there's a scene sort of near the final act where Gurney is having a big battle with this guy who's been trying to kill basically the entire film. And for that battle, they bring back the bagpipes theme of the first film for Gurney, because that's the signal House Atreides. All the stuff which they have for the Bene Gesserit with the female vocals, things like that, is so, so very well chosen in terms of when to do that. And to your point, Clarice, the marriage of sound and score here is fantastic. When to the scene which I mentioned where Chani and Paul are taking out Harkonnen ships, there's a really cool bit where they take out the ship and there's no sound for a second. And then as it comes crashing down, you get the sound, the score returns, it adds so much to the impact of that scene. So the score, I think, is absolutely phenomenal. I want to just talk about really quickly, Javier Bardem is freaking hilarious in this film. Every time he says Nassan Al-Gaib, I started laughing. It was fantastic. Hannah, please, anything more that you'd like to say?
Well, we talk about the cultural appropriation. I feel like it's big. I mean, Hannah, do you want to, I don't want to steal that from you.
I mean, we can talk about Stilgar. I mean, sure, he had funny jokes, but most of them are at the expense of his faith, a faith that's clearly very much based on Islam, from the way they do their prayers. Like, looking at it, that's how they do it, the rubbing of face, that is Muslim.
And there's like a mat. I mean, it's folded.
Yeah, prayer mat.
It's not the same, but it's...
I mean, look, if we were ever wondering how much this is basically cultural appropriation of Islamic, North African, Middle Eastern cultures, this film confirms that it absolutely is. I find that, you know, you said that, you know, Chani is like the kind of voice of reason for this, of like, you know, she's, as I said, she's devout to a nation, skeptical of their faith. But, you know, how do all that we see of the Fremen are either fighting, sometimes chatting around, or talking about, or being like totally, you know, fanatics. And I think, you know, and they call about the fundamentalists in the South. And for me, that's such a reductive, superficial storytelling there and character development. We don't see, you know, we have all these Fremen who are mostly masked. So you're not actually seeing any of these faces. I mean, Sihelia Yacoub as, I forget her character's name, but in it, I liked her. She's the only one who sounds like she can actually read the language, which is inspired by Arabic, but they've tweaked it a bit. She's the only one who says it with a fluid ease. The rest of it just sounds. There's a joke about where it goes, Stilgar's accent. He said, oh, it's like, oh, can't you tell he's from the South? And then later, and it's like, hold on a second, Chani's got an American California girl accent. It kind of
is the South Spain?
I mean. It's like, it was such a nonsensical joke, but also a reminder that, like, you know, the later on, I said there's a bit in it where, like, the one guy goes, says the Mahdi, and he says it like he's saying Mahdi, and it's a Scottish lilt. It's just like really all over the place, but all of them wear abayas, kefirs, niqabs, like hijabs. The fact that Rebecca Ferguson becomes Reverend Mother, and then suddenly she's got the tattoos over her face and very specific Imazighen indigenous, like, you know, you see a lot of them in Algerian Bedouin women there. But then we, you know, the whole point about the Reverend Mothers is that they're supposed to get every single bit of history and tradition from that, you know, of life. But, you know, and she robs it basically because she's kind of set this all up. But we don't see any of it. Like, we don't see anything. And even, I will say, we haven't even really talked about the kind of the Harkonnens and the Carinos, like, which is the Emperor and Princess Arulan, which very much, again, positions this as a very... Christians versus Muslims, Crusades, you know, kind of imagery, European, pseudo-Europeans, you know, even though the Harkonnens are a bit more like Bergen nightclub attendees, sadomasochist, kinky bitches. But like, you look at the kind of the emperors and go there, it's like the kind of leafy pastures of like England. It really feels like that. Even the like
chain mails.
Yeah, the chain mail. The Sardaukar outfits, which are very, seem very much like Richard the Lionheart, sort of Knights Templar look. So the fact that they've kind of once positioned this as a very specific thing and used it, and then, you know, again, there's like a dearth of actual kind of actors in it who are from that. I still feel like Stilgar is cosplaying as a Bedouin Arab. Yeah, he's quite funny. There's one bit where I thought it was quite funny about, but even that is like talking about jinn. Jinn is an Islamic name for a genie. Like, you know what I mean? Like a demon. And so, yeah, it's really, it is really disappointing to kind of, and also it's disappointing because, you know, you come away from this yet another June press cycle where people of my heritage have been excluded from doing any interview times with these people to actually ask a question about it. It's interesting. Someone emailed me about this, and it's funny how, like, you know, and then you were saying the other day, Amon, about, you know, who gets, you know, these TikTok interviews where people go get time. But no one asks about it. No one gets to not confront, but kind of say, what's crack-a-lacking, what's going on? So I guess it's just, you know,
There is no escaping just how much appropriation it is in this film.
Can I ask? Because I'd be interested in your opinion on that. Because I think, like, just from obviously, like, my white ass watching it, I was like, what really bothered me was Javier Bardem. Every time he was on screen, I was like, this feels viscerally weird. But it's interesting hearing kind of your perspective on some of the wider choices of representation in terms of what culture is shown on screen.
Yeah.
Do you think, how differently would you feel about it if everything had stayed the same, but Chani and Stilgar were played by Middle Eastern and North African actors? Do you think that would be a huge improvement, or would it not? Would it still feel...
Well, for Chani, I wouldn't mind it, because in a way she's kind of like... You know, Stilgar is, I think, even more of a gross stereotype in this than in the film than he is in the book. And I think that's because of a lot of what I was saying about, like, you know, we can talk about Frank Herbert's book being like dense and stuff like that, but what you get with that book is a real understanding that these, you know, they're not just barbarians, they're a pragmatic society. They survive on group feeling, like, you know, and I think, you know, this thing I was talking about with Ibn Khaldun, he talks about civilizations and, like, you know, sedentary culture is represented by Baron Harkonnen. You know, he's in that, you know, he's just pure excess, right? He just has that bath all the time. He needs help. He is like the visualization of urban civilizations, where people have got so used to other things, like helping them, like technology and stuff, that they just basically become kind of like shelves on themselves, you know. And then you have the Fremen, which I think, you know, what I wish that they did more in the film is really celebrate that, you know, there's certain things of, like, I know, I guess it's the visualization of it, but this sense of community and solidarity, like, and we don't see as much about the kind of kids and the family element of the Fremen that actually I think the book gets into a bit more. So it's quite, again, it's quite superficial reading. I think, yeah, and that's the thing. I found the Christian versus Muslim sort of aesthetic themes that's carried on. I found it like, well, this is kind of well trodden and obvious. You know, you could have had the Padishah Emperor be, you know, have an Ottoman or like Korean, do you know what I mean? Persian sort of feel to it. That would have worked. And again, like, you know, we haven't even talked about the acts. Christopher Walken, go girl, give me nothing. It kind of was just getting him to do it. And he's like the most mundane, boring emperor ever. Florence is fine. You know, she's just doing the kind of very stoic. I'm sure in Dune Messiah, the next one, there'll be more to, obviously we'll get far more to it than that. But that was the kind of like, well, I'll get into that kind of basic like love triangle at the end. And so certainly the end bit I felt was like, oh, this, this felt like why a romance novel a little bit. And Austin Butler doing a Stellan Skarsgård accent, which wasn't that bad. But
I loved it. Going, I loved what good. Austin Butler was doing.
I thought it was fantastic. Wow.
I guess it's just a thing. I'm an
Austin Butler fan now. Yeah. I'm sold on that guy.
But to what you were saying, it's like, I don't know if it would have been any better, but especially if this is the version of Stilgar that you would get. But half of the point of it is as well, is that, like, you know, so often Muslim, North African, Middle Eastern culture is taken. I think a perfect example is Anya Taylor-Joy's choice to wear this outfit on the red carpet, where it's like, when she covers her hair in that sort of way, that's fashion. But when a Muslim woman wears a headdress, that's oppression. And I think that's what I find frustrating. It's like, you'll take all these things and then rob them of their kind of origin, and you'll use the Muslimness to kind of fit into your world and make it exotic, but then you'll kind of keep out the people who might actually benefit from, you know, having them, having their face in one of the biggest movies ever, you know? It's a really complicated question, because it's like, it is really like, you know, it's such scraps, right? But I just feel like this is, it's very clear that this is such, you know, like so much of it is basically stolen from these cultures and then perpetuate this kind of like rivalry between Christian Muslim kind of countries. And yet it's like, let's just strip it off anyone who could actually meaningfully kind of fill these roles where it's more than just cosplay.
I guess what struck me this week about, like, really the double standard of, like, representation is, I don't know if you guys watch Shogun.
Not yet,
but I watched that series. It's great. Mm-hmm. But if you read about the process of making that show, where they hired a Japanese American creator, and then she was like, shit, Japanese American is not enough. She went to find like loads of collaborators who, and they had like a writer's room that was all Asian American, or not all, but I think dominated by Asian American women in the writer's room to really get the female characters right, because they're not very good in the book. And then they like went out to find, you know, Japanese playwrights and historical experts as producers, writers, like costumers, and you just read about all this like care that they put into it. And I know it's obviously Shogun is real Japanese history. I understand that it's different things, but it really struck me to be like, oh, because the, and I don't think it's because like Disney or, you know, the best and amazing today. It's because they knew they'd get in so much fucking shit if they didn't do that.
Yeah.
Why doesn't that apply to this?
Because it's sci-fi and everyone loves to say, oh, it's set 20,000 years in the future. Why?
Yeah. You know, it doesn't seem like, it just doesn't seem like everything that you've said, then it's like, well, that's, it's just not enough an excuse to have so little care, I think.
But it's also just, you know, it's interesting. When will we ever get a show like Shogun that grapples with like, you know, if, for example, like, you know, because I'm obsessed, but like Hannibal, like Carthage, ancient Carthage. When would there ever be a show like that made? And if there was a show made, it would, well, actually the movie's getting made and it's going to be the worst popular, like Antoine Fuqua and Denzel Washington doing Hannibal. That's like, for me, once again, shows a clear, like, an interest in actually getting authentic stories being told. So I think it's just basically, once again, Arab Islamic representation is at the bottom of the bottom of the ladder when it comes to actually doing things. Like, look, something like Black Adam is a perfect example. It's supposed to be like an authentically like thing, but who was the people who wrote it? Who were the people who made it? Who was the lead? None of them are like Middle East and North Africans. So
let's go to our screen stream or skip recommendations on June : Part 2, Clarice Lockley.
I mean, screen, definitely. But, you know, I think everything that we talked about, it's, this is the thing with like hard sci-fi and hard fantasy. We're going to keep coming up with these issues if we're going back to adapt older things. Because this is the same shit with Lord of the Rings, has some really awful scenes in it. Because I don't, we need to have like a consciousness of when adapting this stuff because they're incredible books, but you know.
Yeah. Hannah Flint.
I say, my heart's telling me skip, but I guess if you've already seen the first one, stream.
You can say skip.
Yeah, I don't know. It just feels like it's one of those things. I'm trying to give a recommendation, and I know I've got a very specific point of view, so I don't mind. I don't really care. On this one, I just really kind of want to abstain, but you know what I mean? Because it's like, I don't know. Maybe, okay, I'll just say skip then. That'll be true to heart.
I'm going to say screen with caveats that we have discussed.
Okay, well, let's continue the Dune chat with our
Here's the mantra.
Okay, let's sand walk into these spoilers then, I guess. Well, I guess one of the big things which was interesting. So you mentioned Anya Taylor-Joy being on a red carpet. There's a reason for that. She's playing Alia in, I guess, in Doom Messiah. We see her, an older version of her. Interestingly, it was funny because when I watched the film, I was like, because I haven't read the book in like, God, about 5 years or something. So as soon as I got home, I needed to read the last chapter again because I was like, wait, this is not how I remember it. And I realized one of the big, and also there's a lot of bit when it comes to kind of like some real tragedy that goes on, which I do think is a real, I feel that that sort of depth, kind of emotion is what is not delivered on here, which I think would have gone a lot further, as in Chani and Paul have their own child, which they call Vito.
I did not know that. Okay.
Yeah, they have a baby and it gets killed, and the baby gets killed while during that assault. And then we have like her finding out that, you know, and I think they've led to it a little bit more, but Chani in the book is definitely far more pragmatic, and she kind of like, not pregnant. It's not that she's not more pragmatic on the screen, but she's less, she's kind of like understands the situation. There's a bond between her and for me and Paul that's established for this shared knowledge that they bring together between us, which I think.
And Lady Jessica kind of just go, okay, because Lady Jessica was like, I was a concubine, it's chill, it's fine.
Yeah, yeah, I think.
Charlie's like, all right.
But I think it's more like, but I quite like this sort of kind of, there's this sort of kind of, I think what I really enjoy about why I like that in the book was because it once again, this is because I think, you know, I might should have probably said this in the main part body of the review, but this is a real anti-Messiah film. It's really anti-Messiah. And with that, it also, the fact that Bene Gesserit, like, they're, as much as they're in power, they're not. As in they are, but they're always behind men. And the sacrifice that these women have to make in order to do this, but also it can be quite corrupting. And I think what that final scene in the book, I think really grasps what, one, it's a woman's voice that's end on, but like it is really saying like, no matter what, this sucks. This kind of world sucks because of these problems. And I think that's what it really grapples with. So when Chani leaves in a huff and goes on a sandworm, that annoyed me because I just felt like that didn't feel like the character. That didn't feel like, yeah, I guess it changed. But also the big one, but anyway, the fact that, so the one I was referring earlier with the scarf thing, Fremen, when they are pregnant, they wear a scarf to show that they're pregnant. That's a symbol. So I wondered if that was it, but I guess, you know, Clarice, you've read the book as well.
Yeah, I think that plot line would have been too much, and I wonder whether they're going to save it for Dune. Because what's happened, obviously, is that he's pulled forward some of the stuff from Dune Messiah so that nobody comes away from the movie with any confusion about Paul. Because that's the thing, a lot of readers didn't really get the anti-Messiah thing when the first Dune book came out. And so I kind of liked that he pulled a little bit of that forward, and like he added the stuff with the stuff with the nukes, I think that felt, yeah, I know, because they have the nukes are there, the Atreides nukes are in the book, but I can't remember what happens to them.
No, but there's the thing is the, and they show it in the film where they shoot the land rather than they shoot it at land. The point was, If they started at the emperor, that would be treason, blah blah blah. And it's like, well, actually, we shot at the earth, you know, a mountain, and that created the thing that caused the issue. So I think that was the issue, that the kind of loophole that they got around for it. I don't know. I do think that they could have had, I guess, but again, this is what's so interesting about the book, and I get what you're saying, because you do get more of the fanaticism certainly in the second part, but then it also, that by doing that, that also is reductive on the Fremen to say that they immediately like that. And I think, as much as, you know, I do think that it does underexpress like the reason why he was worried about the future. Like there's that bit where he kind of shows Chani like burnt, and then there's that bit where people starving and stuff, but like the fact that they refuse to say jihad or anything like that, you know what I mean? They refuse to say things like that. It's like, I don't think it's as explicitly clear that the reason why he has basically embraced this false idolatry, this manufactured fate, it's kind of like, you know, I think about like Infinity War, and Doctor Strange is like looking at all the options, and it's like, this is the one way out. And it's like, we have to lose to win. And I guess that's for me what this kind of thing is, right?
Paul's, but that's like, what I thought was so cool about that thing with the hand. What I can say, what I was referencing now, is when Paul takes the water of life. I loved that what you're talking about to me was summed up by him going, there are many pairs, and he kind of moves his hand. but I see the way forward. And that's because he's had, that's his like Doctor Strange moment.
Yeah. No, I get it.
You've made me do that comparison.
I'm so sorry. But what I'm saying, yes, that's a good moment. But I guess it's like, I don't think it's as clear that this is going to be this genocide that happens.
Right.
I don't think it's clear that there's going to be a genocide where it causes the deaths of like fucking half the universe. Do you know what I mean? Like that sort of thing.
I think for me, I think it might have been a line of dialogue from Dune Part 1, which I rewatched ahead of Dune Part 2. But there is a line, either in Dune Part 1 or Dune Part 2, in which Paul says, like, he sees a vision where billions of people die. And there are flashbacks or visions that this film periodically cuts to of that happening, or being one of the potential futures that Paul has seen. So for me, it felt clear enough about what the potential to happen would look like.
I kind of get what you mean, though, that it's like they do set up something really bad is going to happen, but the book is so much more, obviously, yeah, the lack of...
And they got their ruling.
Yeah.
This is so funny.
I get what you mean. I think it didn't bother me so much because, like, the tonally... the end of that of Dune Part 2 is so heavy that, and so I found the ending so menacing. Like,
me too.
I don't think I've ever seen a mainstream movie that had such menace to the its ending in my life. I know people are saying comparing it to Empire Strikes Back, that's a relatively happy ending. But with like lose. A little bit of like, yeah, they lose, but then they're like, yeah, but we got
Infinity
each other.
War, they lose.
But they got each other. This one's like, oh, the worst shit imaginable is about to happen.
Yeah.
See you in 2 years. Bye. It's like, just, ugh. Like, I've, ugh. But I think that's why it worked so well for
but
me.
But I guess, one of the things that, again, what I love about Dune is that, like, the Baron Harkonnen death. Alia kills Baron Harkonnen. Like, that's fucking weird as shit. Fucking amazing. And they've kind of, again, it's that sanitization somewhat for me of this, like, yeah, that the franchise, like, the fact that she's, like, this, like, abomination. And then she manages to come in. I just think the character's so weird and scary. And I think, you know what I mean? I understand why they cut things out and do some things, but it's also like, this is a 2 hour, 48 minute movie. Like, I feel like, be better writers.
I feel like there's a separate hot take about narrative liberties with adaptations and how much is too much that we could do.
Would you take the trade? You get Alia, but the movie's 3 hours long. 3.5 hours long. You don't have your full other hour, but you get Alia.
It is this thing, though. I guess it's kind of, and you know, I've just wrote a piece about two-parters and about, I guess, like, so like something like Bertolucci's 1900, which it's like 5 hours, the original cut. Jeez. And he did it as Act One and Act Two. Or you could say like Kill Bill Volume One, but it was like one film, but it's split into two. Or like if you had something like Kill Bill Volume One and Two, which is originally they wanted to do it as a one film, but it was too long. And in the edit process, they decided we're going to split this into two films and then we're going to reshoot some scenes and make it one because it's about the artistic vision and all that type of thing. But I guess with this one, like, but I, you know, I haven't seen the 1900, but I was still speaking to Bilger Abiri for this piece about it. And he was like, you know, they feel like really distinctive narratives in each one. And one's quite like light and the other one's like very like communist epic. And I think Kill Bill Volume 1 and Volume 2, they work as discrete products, but they've got a real like narrative identity and tonal identity in different versions. And I guess for me with Dune Part 1 and Part 2 is that, if you're going to, for, you know, I understand the limitations of making it as one movie. So I'm not opposed to someone doing a film in two parts. But I feel like for me, I need a decent, like, you know, a lot of, you said, like, a lot of Dune Part 1 is just set up. It's a lot of, you know, planes landing and docking. Like, there's not a lot that goes on there. And I didn't come away like something like Infinity War or Endgame where, you know, a cliffhanger bridges them. And then suddenly work as a two-part kind of like ending. Whereas this one, it just felt, I don't know if, I think the clarity of storytelling and the depth of characters. So I don't include Paul and Jessica on this because I do think that was really good. And I think one thing that June, the book is really good is the interiority. And yes, it's thick and dense, but it's, I think you get the emotional core. And I don't know, maybe I'm a too much of a literal person that I need things told. Not always, I guess. I don't think that's true for me, but I guess there's a balance of like what you're showing versus what you're telling. And I felt sometimes Denis Villeneuve leaned too heavily into, I'm going to show you things and hope you get it. and I'm someone who's read the book, so I don't know if there's things, but Iman, you haven't obviously, and you love
that's it, interesting. So. I'm the opposite. I love being shown things because then my brain goes, oh my God, it's that. And I feel
no, I like- guess. Yeah,
I'm in the movie and I solved it.
But I guess it's I consider myself someone who, I don't know, maybe I don't always need that, I guess. I think for me, just on a sense, I think because some of the things in here, it's easy to be misinterpreted, this film and this book. Because, you know, I really rally against anyone who calls this a white savior narrative or if this is a messiah film. It's absolutely not. Mm-hmm. And I do appreciate how much this set is, certainly this part really does make it clear he does not want to be the messiah. He really doesn't want to be the messiah. He's a reluctant Mahdi. He doesn't want to do it. I guess it's just like the why doesn't he want to do it for me is not clear enough. And I think my point is that there's 2 hours 48 minutes in this film where you could have, you know, had a bit more time doing stuff, but he's so, you know, he's obsessed with big, grandiose images. He lingers on things that I feel like stop lingering there. Do you have to let it linger? Do you have to?
Yeah, that's interesting.
You know,
for me, it was clear enough. Like, it makes multiple sort of references. You know why I can't go south. He tells Chani at multiple points, like, I can't do it. I don't want to do it. And I think maybe because
No, but that's not what I'm talking about. You know, I know, again, he gets into, he doesn't want to become this religious leader. He knows if he goes, that's very clear. And that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying about the future of the thing. I don't think it is very clear that if he becomes a leader, he's going to lead these Fremen into committing a genocide against the world, blah, blah, blah. I think they talk about it in very, like, vague terms.
Okay.
That's my issue. I think it should be, because then it's like a real understanding of like, yo, there's some real... I don't think it's, yeah, I don't know.
Well, yeah, because you know that there's that holy war will be in my name. So I think, like, you are right. They don't talk about how, because in the book, you know exactly how that holy war is fought under his name. I feel like in the movie, it's sort of left to, which I think, you know, for people, you can sort of figure it out. But you're right that I do think the movie kind of chooses to imply and has a certain amount of like just trust in the audience, which can in this kind of circumstance go bad knowing the lack of media literacy in the world. So I see what you mean, that it opens it up, I think, to
I'm gonna find the scene in Dune Part One in which they spell this out and send it to you and see what you
guys think. It's one in the tent where he's like talking to Lady Jessica and he's like, "Oh, what yeah, am I know the scene." Yeah.
So, do you think there should have been more of that in Dune Part Two? Is essentially what
you're
saying.
Well, but also, right? But also, if you're gonna, you can't just like put something in the first film in one scene and say that's the job for the second. Right, I've done that. You've got to give me every bit of information I need in this movie. You know, that's what I think the problem is about this sort of thing. It's like, I don't know. I think you can't, you know, two years since Dune came out? 2-3 years?
Yeah.
So yeah. I do think it, but, you know. But I, it, also there's a thing about, right, forgive me if I'm wrong here, Clarice, but the thing where Thingy takes the water of life, is it, does that play out like it does play out in the book? Where Chani comes over and it's suddenly like, I'm pretty sure it doesn't happen like that. And this is doesn't what I mean about
into coma for like a long time.
Yeah, yeah. It's but she more, doesn't. Yeah. But her kissing him and then her yeah. then bringing away, that doesn't happen. And that's what I'm talking about, like the kind of YA of it, like the reverse, like right. Sleeping Beauty situation as a way to empower this woman. It's like, you know, it's that was like, oh, for me, that was so kind of trite. And again, it's like, I don't know, this over romanticized version. What I loved about Chani and Paul, it's a very pragmatic but like soulful love. And I really don't feel like that's I didn't feel that, because I felt they were trying to do this strong female characterization of her to say, hey, I don't need your help. Are you gonna mansplain sand walking to me? Or, you know, things like that. And I don't know. I felt like that for me was a bit And that's not on Zendaya's fault. That's not Zendaya's fault. I kind of blame the writing here.
Can I just clarify something? For me, it wasn't Chani kissing Paul that brought him to life. It was the desert spring tears that brought Paul back to life.
Yeah, but it's a, okay, kiss or the tears is her crying or something, but it yeah. still doesn't happen in the book. Okay. It's something they've added that gives it this kind of Sleeping Beauty, you know, Snow White kind of revert gender swap version of that.
I mean,
for me, it's
like, I'm corny.
Yeah, it's corny as shit. And I'm like, one thing you can say about June, it's not corny.
I don't have
a little corny in places.
I don't have the book as a reference point as you guys clearly do, but I thought to me that was really interesting, purely because Chani, as we've said, has rebelled against this religion, has rebelled against this prophecy, doesn't even like the sort of, you know, warrior name that she has, because it's something to do with the prophecy, the desert spring or whatever. And through Paul's actions, she is forced to become part of that prophecy, and she reacts accordingly to that. Like, that adds an interesting wrinkle to their relationship. So I thought that
she's
was
not
really
forced. Wrong. She's yeah. It's not a thing, but she doesn't have to do it. But the whole point is making
doesn't Lady Jessica say, like, do it? Which forces her to...
Yeah, but this scene doesn't happen, so they've basically kind of made out as if, like, her name and all this type of stuff, like, she could have just not done it, and then it'd be done. And if she cared more about whatever. But it's that over-romantic part of it that I find kind of trite. It's like, it's not...
Well, I guess in the movie, it's more... They become more of like a Romeo and Juliet twinned.
Yeah, and I don't like it. Yeah.
I will say, I think if they had done Chani straight like she is in the book, she is very pragmatic to the point in the book that I'm a bit like, oh, geez, you're just going to go with anything, aren't you? Like, she's just sort of like, she has that conversation with Jessica and she's like, I'm all right with this then, I guess. I liked that they added a little bit more. I can see that it's like, it's quite Hollywood. They turned it into quite a Hollywood romance storyline.
Yeah.
I quite like that stuff because I'm corny as fuck and I like faded romances and destiny and twin stars and things. But yeah, she's different.
Can we talk about that final scene, that final fight, because as I said, I thought it was really, really well done. And as somebody who hadn't read the book, yes, intellectually I could figure out who was probably going to win that fight, but I was so in the moment and I was really into it and my heart was beating really fast, and the reaction shots that they do throughout that fight really adds to the sense of maybe, just maybe, something that we don't expect is going to happen is going to happen. And yeah, the reaction shots are so well done, between the camera panning to Rebecca Ferguson as Lady Jessica, who at one point, when Paul is stabbed, sort of gets up out of her chair. Then you have the looks that Gurney, Josh Brolin, is given, because, you know, this is his boy and he's getting stabbed. He could die. All that sort of stuff just added to the, and obviously the fact that there's no music at all. I thought it was really, really well done. Hannah, I know that you feel differently.
I just found that the whole thing ending, and I think again, a lot of the kind of end part of Dune is kind of getting into the court intrigue about like getting into court dynamics. And, you know, one of the bits that I think is great in the book where Alia is like, yeah, you captured me because I let you capture me. And I'm basically just like set this up so I can stab Baron Harkonnen in the neck, you know? And there's something about those kind of like, you know, dialogue scenes and you seeing these things pan out and like, and even, you know, and what like, doesn't really make sense to me about that fight sequence is that if Austin Butler nearly loses to a guy, a prisoner, a former, like, you know, Leto warrior, right? You know that sequence in the black and white, the monochrome thing? If he's nearly going to die by the hand of someone who hasn't been fed properly for, like, for weeks on end or whatever, how long have it been? And he's like, how is it that he is able to get a stab in against Paul, who is one of the best chosen people? Again, that doesn't happen in the book, but I guess for, like, let's make it drama. I don't know. I found that... I don't think that the fight sequences, I think there's some real style in the way, I guess with the way the style, it's like the early one where the Harkonnens come in, where they're coming down and suddenly they're getting shot off the thing and hit. So those sequences are done well. And I do think like the, some of the, you know, I think some of the setup to the sequences are great. Or the end is like, you know, when the half a spice harvesters come in and you see this little mouse, the Maldive, like desert mouse on it. And then you see the thing and it's like, oh, there's clearly going to be Fremen underneath that. And then they jump up, which is great. Or like little things like that. But I think, I don't know if I think that the actual fight sequences are that astonishing for me. And again, I would have loved more of a fight. Like in the first film, we got far more fight sequences, action set pieces from the invasion of Caladan than we did in that final section of this final battle against thingy. Because basically that whole film is like the overthrow of, sorry, not Caladan, overthrow of Arakeen, right?
Yeah.
So I guess for me, it just felt a bit underwhelming. And then Chani running off on a sandworm. And that was a cliffhanger I didn't enjoy.
I liked it. She sent him out. I don't know. I think that's just because I never really understood why she was so chill with it in the book.
Again, that but sort of blindsided me. I mean, yeah, to go from, you know, I'll love you as long as I breathe to I'm going to accept the hand of your daughter right in front of us. Like, damn, that was, I didn't see that coming.
But for me, I think what I would have thought about Chani is that what you're saying in the book, how she does it, but she doesn't just accept it. There is a real, like, I really, when the writing in it, it's like this sense of like, you can see her heart dropping out, but she stands there and takes it. And that's like part of the fact that, not takes it, but like, she's a Fremen. She's like, I'm used to this. Like, I won't, and also, I won't shed my tears. Like, shedding your water is so against the Fremen face. So, the idea that, like, she would just run off like a jaded lover, you know, that, or like, that for me was like hysterical. And that annoyed me. I felt like that was just like a teen YA move. Like, fuck you, I'm running off. Whereas, like, for me, what I would have understood about that character and the world that they're in. And remember, this is the world that they're in, not our projection of this society of like female empowerment, blah, blah, blah. This is the world that they live in, right? And like, and I felt like if she'd have just stood there, like waited there and there'd be a look and you just see it and you could have felt it. I mean, you talk about Lily Gladstone being an amazing performance in Killers of the Flower Moon, saying, oh, you know, this whole thing about, you know, she doesn't say much, but it's in her face and she's basically letting her husband kill her. But we can't believe why Chani would stand by. That's what, like, that scene would have played out better if it was a bit more like Lily Gladstone in that thing to understand, like, this isn't easy for her, but it's something about her that's keeping her there. So, yeah.
For me, I felt the hurt and the anger that Chani felt before she stormed off, because they do linger on her face for a good few seconds.
She should have stayed there and it would have been far more like compelling to me of like, fuck, this woman is having to hear all this at once. And I mean, the thing is about this, what's wild is that like in the book, her child has just been murdered and she has to stick around as well. And I just think, fuck, this is a woman who's like, and I guess it's part of this sort of like selflessness. I guess it's the selflessness of her and the group feeling of the Fremen and being part of something that is bigger than yourself. And that's why Fremen survive, right? It's because of, it's about the community, not about the individuals. And that's, for me, is why I understand Chani as a character. Like, she understand, I guess it's that understanding of how do we survive? What is the best survival for the group? And to have, for understanding what's going on, you know, for the Fremen, it's kind of like, this is their survival to get their land back to whatever. And sure, it ends badly. But for me, that is what the key to that community is. But we don't get that in the film. We don't get that sense in the film because they don't explain it. That group feeling, there's not enough time spent with them. It's all about Paul doing his training, doing all this type of stuff. But the very slim moments that we see the Fremen meet up is joking about Faith, them being fanatical about Faith. But where's the actually who they are beyond that? And I think that's the real, one of the real problems of the film. So that's why you don't really understand, for me, why you don't really understand, like, I guess.
Well, I guess it's a choice between, it's kind of like, yeah, loyalty to community versus to romantic love.
Yeah.
And the film kind of chooses the opposite. If you think about, like, the book, yeah, the book chooses her heart ultimately lies with her community, and the movie has decided, no, she feels too strongly for Paul, too. Which I think that's just like my that's more of a me thing.
But then I'd be
pissed and I'd run because I have less family loyalty, I guess.
But then you're rewriting the character. And then that's not the character.
Which
I guess that's
agree with.
That's, and I want to give like license to, you know, there's a difference to doing a loose adaptation, but this has prided itself on being, we need to do this across two movies because it's so dense and detailed that we need to get it right. And for me, they've changed that character. And I don't know. I think, yeah, to make a more strong female character rather than accepting that she's the character within this world and this world is flawed. Like, there, as I said, there are really no good guys in Dune. Like, everyone's in some way a villain. And even tacit endorsement of, like, you know, letting Paul go ahead is also, in a way, complicity, right? So I think everyone's either responsible or complicit, you know?
Yeah, I guess for me as well, I think in the film, because it's the condensing of it, because you kind of have Lady Jessica as someone who has chosen duty over kind of love in a way.
No, so, but she's been selfish, though. She'd made sure she went against, it's self-serving, but she did. She chose the duty, but she wanted her child to be.
Yeah, but it's sort of like there's sort of a similar, the similar ideas are kind of brewing. So I can kind of maybe see them going. But yeah, I don't know. I think ultimately it's just personal feeling about whether it's justified to change that character or not.
Yeah. These are things that I've never considered because I haven't read the book. So I'm coming at it from a different lens. But what you're saying is very interesting to me. Yeah, I don't know if I want to read the book.
I have to say, I did really enjoy the sandworms. I did enjoy them. And I thought, I thought that was good. Yeah.
Just little moments.
Why aren't they selling the popcorn bucket? I want it.
the anus bucket.
I want it. That'd be so funny. I saw somebody who took a photo. They'd taken the top off and it's like where they put their remotes in now.
Oh, wow.
That's so funny. I did find it funny that the minute that Paul wakes up from his like coma thing, it's like, I've got a black cape on, I'm emo Paul. When he's going through the sand, I was like, that's the most emo shit I've ever seen.
And he had the like dark eyeshadow under his eyes.
Yeah.
I was like, that's such a shortcut, but I love it. It's giving Anakin.
The score on that scene is just so phenomenal. Just boom, doom, 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 boom, doom. And it's just,
but it is funny you say that, the Skywalker thing, because it's like, Dune is a riff off of Star Wars, and like, definitely in each version of it. No, sorry, Star Wars is rip-off of Dune. Yeah. Sorry, I'm wrong. But, like, even that bit is, like, you know, fate and all this type of stuff. Anyway.
I mean, that's, we're hearing for that discussion, but I think everything we've been talking about would be interesting to talk about in the context of how much the Dune adaptation is influenced by the fact that Star Wars has over kind of run Dune as the biggest sci-fi influence in filmmaking, cinema storytelling.
Yeah. I wonder, like, though, not, if I would have been, I will say this, I would have, I don't know if you ever saw the Children of Dune series that sci-fi did and had James McAvoy in it. And I wonder if, like, it's the sort of thing that works better as a long, as TV series, like episodic.
They're eventually probably going to do that.
Yeah. Also, I loved Lea Seydoux just turning up and being, oh, God, of course I'm the sexy one. It's going to fuck.
Did not see that Gum Jabbar test coming, but I think they did that well.
That was good. I actually quite enjoyed the monochrome world.
Yeah, that was cool.
But it also goes to show as well, like, Dave Bautista, like, kind of a mixed race actor, basically been depicted as raceless because they make it so high contrast, like, with the whiteness that he's not actually, he's one of the Harkonnens who are all white. I thought that was quite, you know.
That's one of the things that I didn't like about the film, actually, the way Dave Bautista's character goes out. I was expecting a bigger battle between he and Gurney, because Gurney, as we've seen, that he's a formidable fighter, and there are moments in Dune Part 2 where he's like, you know, this guy, Riban, like, he left his mark on me, I'm going to get him. So the fact that he left his mark on Gurney would seem to indicate that, oh, this guy is legit. So when they come to blows, I was like, okay, this could last for a minute or so, and it lasted about 5 seconds. And that was a bit unsatisfying to me.
I have to say, when he kept on calling the Fremen rats, I found that fight quite not triggering, but I guess it was like kind of just because of what's going on nowadays. And like, we obviously know what these Fremen are coded as. And then seeing like the way the kind of real dehumanization that's going on in Palestine and Gaza, that was quite. And then it also goes back to, you know, even, you know, watching Inglourious Basterds, you know, that scene with first scene with Christopher Walken, he's talking about rats as. And it's describing the Jewish characters, and it's just such colonial language. I do think, like, you know, it could have done it a bit harder on avoiding the good versus bad, because I still think they position the Duke Leto's family, the House of Atreides, as if they're heroic, when actually they're the ones, they still maintain an order. They were still, you know, lords of Arrakis, stealing from the land, maintaining this situation. I think it still played into a good for bad by under kind of grappling with that imperialism that and colonialist element to it.
They could do more to heighten it, but they do allude to it. Like, one of the final lines of the film is like, you know, sides. There are no sides. You should know better. So they do kind of allude to it, but they could have sort of heightened it more, I guess.
I was going to say, because I guess the thing with the House of Treaties is that they get wiped out before, and this is again what you're talking about, dialogue versus visual representation, is that a lot of their oppression would have come if they hadn't died, basically, because they land and they get wiped out before they have a chance to do anything. But yeah, you're relying a lot on Chani's, who will our next oppressors be, to be able to link that. I agree. It's kind of, I feel like in the movie, for me, they seem, it's sort of like a neutral, but there could have been more clarification of what, where they would have gone if they hadn't just immediately been all killed off.
And also getting into the wide,
less charismatic as Duke Leto.
And I think it's also zooming out a bit more on the kind of politics, the interstellar politics at play, the universe, what the spice, the navigators, those things. I think that, I guess,
They don't mention that, do they, in the movies?
Yeah, I guess it's like this streamlining. I think there's always going to be element of streamlining when it comes to doing adaptations of dense books. And yeah, so I guess it's kind of pick and choose what you put in. But I would have really liked to have seen Alia stab Baron Harkonnen in the neck.
What is happening, mother?
I do like their conversations.
They were weird. I quite like it. It's very Rose the Hat sometimes in moments with Rebecca Ferguson, I felt. Yeah.
I was a little bit surprised that nobody, and I mean nobody, Paul just walked into there and stabbed him in the neck, like, and nobody gonna defend Baron? I mean, I know he's an ass, but...
Yeah. I think it would have been... Yeah, but the also, I guess...
too fast. No one
yeah. Yeah.
You die like an animal, grandfather.
Yeah. Okay, all right. Well, that's it for this week. Thank you for tuning in. Happy viewing via whatever medium is safest for you. Please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. It makes a difference. And tweet us any questions or hot takes at @FadeToBlackPod on Twitter. I'm at Hannah Ness Flint on Instagram and Letterboxd.
I'm at Clarice Liu on Twitter or at Clarice Lockery on Instagram.
And I'm at Amon Woman on Twitter and Instagram.
Farewell, film friends. It's time to fade to black.